Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 22nd, 2003. Today's session is entitled, Everything You Wanted to Know About Politics But Were Afraid to Ask. A forum with Minnesota State Senator John Marty. Let's listen in.
The forum tonight is not meant to be presentation, then discussion. It's meant to be discussion, basically whatever people want to talk about politics. And I'm not going to start with anything major, but just say to throw out some potential topics. I'm happy to talk about any particular issues or whatever. I'm a state legislator, so don't deal directly with national issues, but the way this was advertised was that it was to talk about whatever questions people had about what happens behind the scenes in government. Can talk about things about whether the role of a politician is to mirror public opinion or use their own judgment, or we're going to talk tomorrow on campaign finance reform and the impact of special interest money. But as I said, I don't want to set the agenda. Everything you ever wanted to know about politics but were afraid to ask. So this is the night to ask if you have any ideas or something. And with that, I'll open it up and see who wants to start off with something. And by the way, this can be a debate type of thing too, if you want to challenge something being said either by me or by somebody else. Go ahead.
The tax code is something that's not understandable by most people. And I hear it often said that it's been crafted behind closed doors to favor particular groups. How much truth is there to this, and what could ever be done about it?
Okay, well, first of all, on tax code, the federal one, like every state one, is very different from each other. But I think it's a fair assessment that a lot of them are crafted by people seeking little favors or advantages for their particular type of business or person. And yes, they are very hard to understand, as are spending formulas. When a state government gives out money, as most states do, to schools and local governments, it often is done by, there's a lot of negotiation. Hey, I don't want to hurt this community in my district, gets hurt by the formula. I'll try and beef it up that way. And so there's a lot of people trying to. Formulas are not always fair and they're not always understandable. But if you look at the tax code, some taxes are based on a flat amount per thing, an excise tax, a certain price per ounce or per barrel of beer. Other things are priced on sales price, like a sales tax, others on amount you own, like property tax. Some states tax your home with just the real value, the real estate value, but some tax the internal possessions in it too. More importantly, that happens in businesses. So some states, Minnesota just taxes the real property, not the personal property of business. But again, in ours, there's an exception. If you're a utility, we tax the personal property of it too. So all the generation, which is the vast majority of the value of it, is taxed in Minnesota. And then there's the income tax, which is the only tax in Minnesota, only tax nationally, only tax in most states, and many states don't have one, that is based on ability to pay. You have more, you pay more. It's the only tax that way, and we often talk taxes in progressivity, meaning that tax is considered progressive if the more you make, the more you pay. It's considered regressive if the more you make, the less you pay. And most taxes, is percentage of income we're talking
about. Yes.
And most taxes are regressive. A sales tax on food is highly regressive because, frankly, virtually everybody is going to eat roughly the same amount of food. You may spend more of your money at more expensive foods if you have more money, but it's a percentage of your income. Percentage a billionaire pays for food is a lot less than a percentage somebody making $10,000 a year pays for food. So sales tax on food is highly regressive, and some income taxes are fairly progressive. Most are not. Minnesota, the business community always says, we got the most progressive tax code in the country for state taxes. Well, our tax code is regressive. It's just not as regressive as many other states are. So if you make $1 million a year, which a decent number of people, not that many, but a decent number of people do, they'll pay less of their taxes, their income, in total state and local taxes in Minnesota than somebody making $50,000 a year, and they'll pay slightly more than somebody making $10,000 a year. That's just the way the tax code is. I think it's unfair. I think taxes should be based on ability to pay, but that's a big argument. And in terms of special favors, one quick example of that, how it happens, we have a tax that's a dedicated tax going, most taxes go to general purposes, but some gas taxes are often dedicated to roads. In Minnesota, we have a petroleum tank cleanup thing. We've had leaking underground tanks from gas stations and other places for 50, 60 years. Now we've got a problem there. The land, nobody will redevelop. It's just vacant land and it's slowly seeping into groundwater. It costs a lot to clean it up. Petroleum industry decided a few years ago, because a lot of service stations had a lot of big expenses and they'd be deep in debt with it, why don't we put in a blink-on tax every time the fund went below a certain level, pay a quarter of a cent on gasoline for a few months a year to replenish the fund, and that would go to pay 80% or 90% of the cleanup costs, the owner paying the other 10%. Good program, made sense. The business is involved, liked it. It was a reasonable dedication, made sense. But this year, in a conference committee on our environment and economic development budget, one of the House members came in, this is 10 o'clock at night on the last Thursday night of the session, came in, yeah, he has an amendment here, and he apparently talked with several places, but it would be to exempt Northwest Airlines, which is based in the Twin Cities, from paying this quarter cent tax. That would save them about $2 million a year. Oh, they've never paid that much, gotten that much benefit out of it, so he just thought because airlines are suffering and Boeing people here know what airline industry has happened to it, but oh, he just decided airline industry gets other benefits, but he just suggested this. And I said, well, wait a minute, what about who's going to make up the difference? Everybody else buying gas. Why don't we have a public discussion? Why don't we have a hearing on this? Now, no, I think it's a good idea, and he had the votes, and he got it put on there, and it became law. $2 million, it's not $2 million less money, it's a blink-on tax, so everybody else pays $2 million more. Northwest Airlines pays $2 million less. Some lobbyist of theirs talked with him and thought it was a great idea, and they apparently talked to a number of members in the conference committee, and they didn't consult me, they didn't think they had my vote, and they didn't have it, but that didn't matter. Anyway, that's a long answer to several points of it, but go ahead.
How much do you think that the Wellman Memorial Service contributed to Mondale's loss?
In Minnesota, which totally had an impact nationally, Paul Wellstone's Memorial Service, I think it definitely had an impact, not so much that people necessarily voted by it, but there was some sympathy because of the death, and it turned around because I was at the memorial service. 99% of the people at the service were, it was Wellstone type of thing in many ways. They had a film tribute to him. They had some speakers. There were about, out of 20,000 people in the room, I think there were 300 people who booed when Trent Lott was introduced. Well, he wasn't introduced, but the cameras, whoever was showing the cameras when the TV station was filming, it was shown on screens inside there so you could see it from way back up in the rafters. And they were showing Trent Lott coming in, and they focused on the Clintons came there, and Teddy Kennedy, and a lot of nationally famous people came there. And a handful of people started cheering, and a number of people cheered. Well, celebrities come in, people, hey, that's exciting. And Trent Lott came in, and not everybody knew him. This was before his scandal a month later. But when the Senate Majority Leader comes into a place for a funeral of a colleague, you don't boo anybody like that. It was outrageous what happened there, but it was 300-400 people doing that, and then one guy who was, nobody heard him speak before. I knew who the guy was, but I'd never heard him speak before, and he went on 20 minutes, and the thing that you would say is somebody who was distraught and trying to do what he thought was the right thing to do, but he went to some of Wellstone's friends who were in Congress who were Republicans and begged them, please do it for Paul's sake. Well, they're friends of Paul Wellstone. They're not going to vote for a Republican Democrat because they were friends of him, however. They didn't vote for him even though they were friends. And it was a kind of irrational pitch, and And I noticed I was not campaigning for about a week there. I think most candidates took off. I mean, they kind of had to. And I went out a couple of days after that service, and everybody at the door, boy, can you believe what happened at that service? It had a real impact. I was number, well, enough about it. I don't think people should vote on things like that, but, you know, people do. And it colors the perception. And some people thought, boy, you know, if this is the way those Democrats have a memorial service, well then, boy, we're not going to vote for them. And in the media, boy, I heard one of the biggest TV stations in Minnesota, guy, nightly news anchor who also does a radio talk show. Oh, I heard him saying he was talking to some Republican activists the next day. And he gave me, oh yeah, I've given you 20 minutes to tell all your views and everything, right? Well, that's 20 minutes to the good to make up for all that other stuff. This is a news anchor who would insist he's not biased one way or another, but I'm going to make up for it. And I mean, the media just hammered away at it. So I think it had a big impact. Rational or not, people vote for people for all kinds of reasons. Yes.
You gave the Northwest Airlines example of this. I know, being from Minnesota and following what happens in the late hours of the session, and in Minnesota we're well known for going into extra sessions, and there's a session every year. But I know that the people get really tired. I've talked with some of the representatives in my neighborhood, and I worry that these things that happen last second, that some of the people vote and they don't really even know what is in a bill. And you get, I don't know, do you ever feel like you voted on things and you find out later after you and your support people read the stuff that, well, we really didn't think it was going this way, it was going that way?
Well, there often are. I'm a believer, and there was a big push. Our former governor was pushing it, which gave attention to it, but not logic to it, but a push for a one house or unicameral legislature. Every business, every nonprofit, every school board, every city council, with about 20 exceptions in the country, have one body. You govern things with the body, not two governing bodies. And then two governing bodies, they come up with 10,000 budget decisions and 10,000 policy decisions, and then you gotta get them all to be the same. So you throw them all into a mix, and the way you get them passed is you put them into bigger bills. Oh, it passed in the House, but not in the Senate. We'll just fold it into this bill. So people do that. And then you have the conference committee, and people, oh yeah, why don't we put in this little provision here? Let's slip this in here too. And oh, we couldn't get this passed here. I'm convinced that, well, the textbook theory is the House will stop some of the Senate's excesses, or the Senate stop some of the House ones. It's the easy way. Lobbyists love the process because they can slip in little provisions without the hearings. I think it's much less accountable. And yes, there very often are bills. You know, what's the provision related to Northwest Airlines giving them a tax break? Well, it was the petroleum fund. The petroleum fund, because it was an environmental thing, was an environmental budget bill. And because the easy way to get things passed is, oh, I had a bill on open meeting law provisions that affected local governments, and the House author of the same bill, he put it into a big omnibus privacy bill, which was a reasonable place for it. It was a privacy or public information bill. And I don't need any more hearings on the bill. I just make sure the Senate adopts the House position on that language, and so on. So it's a troubling process to me, the way we have it. And it does tend to mean things happen at the last minute, and people often vote ignorantly on it. I've seen a thing, tobacco tax cut of $1 billion a couple of years ago in Congress. Paul Wellstone had found this thing. Nobody would admit to how it got in the bill. Somebody put it in the bill, but nobody would say where it came from. I mean, this is at the U.S. level, where there are thousands of staff people. Some states, Minnesota has a decent number. We have state senate is probably 250 employees. Federal level, every member of Congress is like 20 employees. Every member of the Senate, up to 50 or 60 or 100. But things do get slipped in there, and people, if it becomes unpopular, I don't know where that came from. I don't know. Somebody should know. By the way, if you want to comment on things somebody else has said or something I've said, feel free to pursue that. Otherwise, questions or comments or suggestions.
As our nation moves into a kind of post-industrial economy, we're supposed to have a knowledge economy and a service economy, but it appears that that's not really coming out the way it was envisioned. And in fact, a lot of higher-level service jobs, insurance companies and software companies, you contact them now, they're in India or Pakistan or somewhere else. So it seems that if you're part of the credentialed elite, that you do pretty well in that economy, that the people who are not well-educated are going to be left behind, I think. So what role do you think government has in trying to address that?
This is a philosophical issue like the tax thing. And I personally think that in the 1930s, we sort of established a social compact in the country. We had the beginnings of a national decisions made that we've been sort of eating away at in recent years, that there's certain things that we consider fair. It's not unlimited work. There's a 40-hour work week, and that's what you do. That's sort of what you're expected to do as a member of society, work 40 hours a week. And in exchange for that, we're going to pay you at least a minimum wage. And you're not going to get wealthy on the minimum wage, but it'll pay enough that you have your necessities. And at that time, they also plugged in, we're going to have a social security system. So when you retire, certain age you retire, and for the rest of your life, we'll make sure you're not living in poverty. A few years later, 30 years later, they plugged in medical benefits for seniors. They plugged in health care for the poor. We slowly stepped in and said, we're going to provide these basic services and a social compact that you put in 40 hours, that's your duty, and we're going to make sure you're not going to, if you want to get wealthy, you may have to need some luck and some other things and advantages you might not have access to, but we're going to have at least a floor under everyone. And I think that's something that still most Americans believe. If you take a poll of people, how many think working people should be, that we should have a system where some working people can't afford housing or health care and so on, I think 80%+ of the public says, no, that's not fair, that's not right. And our economy has not adjusted to changes. The fact that there's greater need for daycare, is more two worker families are in the workplace. Daycare was kind of free in the past. It wasn't free, but it was seen as free because nobody paid for it. Well, now you've got a daycare system, and the people who do the service jobs that we as Christians might consider most important, dealing with little kids or the elderly or the disabled, people who do one-on-one service work helping other people, those are the dirtiest, low-paid jobs we can give you. A lot of our health care workers don't have health care benefits themselves. Work in nursing homes in Minnesota at $8 an hour. It's a whole lot of people. The economy hasn't kept up with the changes. And if you look at, you can see these studies, and I don't have the exact numbers, but 40 years ago, the average differential between the CEO of a business and average working person may have been
30 to 1.
Now it's 1,000 to 1 kind of thing. And you see people who are making, Michael Eisner of Disney a few years ago, they said he was, how many $1,000 an hour was he making? It's obscene amounts of money. And frankly, I don't care if he makes that much money. I just sort of care that we have a system, and I think government does have a role in this, in making sure that the, making sure that the, that everybody else who's playing by the rules gets a fair shake. And our system is moving away from that. And government very much sets the parameters. It's not like government is neutral. So I think government has an obligation to do that. I think we in this country believe in that sort of social security. the people who opposed Social Security in the 30s and opposed Medicare in the 60s, they don't admit it. I mean, they very quickly move beyond that because 90% of the public likes it. It's just we're slowly eating away at it, and I think we're tearing away that social consensus on it, too.
And speaking of Social Security, how long do you think that will actually be in existence, the actual Social Security benefit?
There's been a lot of push to do things that I think would weaken it a lot. I mean, we could take care of the long-term viability if we remove the cap on it. I mean, if you talk about regressive taxes, that's a major one. What is it, 7.5% the employee puts in there, 9% with Medicare, whatever. Employee puts in that up to 9% of their paycheck up to, what is it, $75,000, $80,000, and then you don't pay any more into it. If you make $1 million a year, you're paying the same as somebody making $75,000. Into it, so it's a regressive tax that way. If you remove that cap and just everybody pays the same, it would be a flat tax, not a progressive one. It wouldn't be regressive. A flat tax for Social Security, I think that basically makes it balance out. Or you could raise the retirement age some or other ways of doing it, but right now the pitch is kind of, hey, we're, you know, the concept of privatizing, is it because the stock market is less trustworthy than government, well, to a certain extent it is, but the other issue is Social Security was not meant for, I put in, my money goes to me. It was never started that way. The first recipients of it didn't pay into it at all. I mean, they were seniors, they needed the help then. And we've never had it funded. It's not like a fully funded pension. It's like we're paying for those who are retired now, and they're gonna pay for us, and so on.
Well, what's the likelihood that I'll see any benefit 30 years?
You'll see benefit 30 years from now because politically they won't be able to do away with it. But whether it's going to be the way it was envisioned, something that would take care of a senior in their retirement, that you were going to be able, you might not, they have every retirement toy you want. You may not be spending every winter in Florida, but you'd at least have the basics taken care of. Well, we're not there anymore. People on minimum Social Security, if they don't have a pension, they're kind of pretty tough luck. And in Minnesota, prescription drugs, which is not covered by Medicare in Minnesota. Some states it is, but in Minnesota it's not. I've met people who cut their pills in half, not because they're told to do that, or they'll take two with one instead of two or whatever, with heart medication, so that kills them. But you don't have the choice, and telling people, you know, that's tough. I just don't think our society has to do that. We've got the money to fix it. We don't have the will right now. And I think the public will is there, but I don't think the public will that's translated into the political will.
Kind of leading into that, I was just wondering if you see any major breakthroughs in the healthcare crisis. Where do you see some reasonable gains made in that, okay, in that area?
By the way, I am going to the board if it has the wrong topic. I'm going to be talking about health care reform on Friday instead of whatever was listed up there. But But I don't see a lot of progress happening in health care right now. And I always had this idea of whatever you call it, health care savings accounts, whatever they're called, health savings accounts. I always thought it was kind of strange. Normally when I put money into savings, it's to buy a new car, or it's to pay for retirement, or pay for kids going to college. Putting money into a bank so I can buy health insurance for a while strikes me as, I mean, the intent is you have a minimal health insurance, and then you have a doctor bill, and you've got the savings account. I don't see a lot of improvement in it. One doctor in Minnesota who was active with a group called Physicians for National Healthcare, he said, you know, he thinks we're going to get health care reform much sooner than he used to think. Why? Because the system's falling apart so much faster.
Right.
And it is falling apart. And we've got the best medical technology, the best medical knowledge, the best trained people in the world. And yet, well, partly because it's not shared with everyone, we have much higher infant mortality rates and other problems than others. And we spend far more than anyone, despite lack of coverage, because we don't do anything in prevention, or very little. We do very little in things like mental health, chemical dependency, and so I think we've got a long way to go. I do think that 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now, if it keeps the same trend, there will be so many people so angry about it that I think it may take building political pressure, which may take more people without it. But what is it? 1 in 6 Americans now don't have health insurance. It's not a good situation, and I just think that the concept that we can't afford to provide health care to people, again, it's not a lack of money, it's a lack of political will. And health care is getting expensive, partly because of new technologies, partly because we don't have the will to do it. And then other things like the pharmaceutical industry, I go on at length about that, I've carried some bills on that. When Minnesota seniors and California seniors go to Mexico or Canada to buy the same drugs, the same menu, often American, dominantly American drug companies, buy the same prescription at an average of 40% less. They're not selling it at a loss in Canada or Mexico. They're making profit on it there. They're price gouging here, and frankly, I don't pay the full amount because of the way it's the most unfree market economy anywhere. It relies on kickbacks. They call them rebates. Kickbacks and health plans, if you have drug coverage for health plan, you and your drug plan, your health plan together pay roughly the rates Canadians or Mexicans would pay for, because they get the kickbacks for them. And so we documented a number of years ago, the National Association of Chain Drug Stores, the big ones, the Oscos and the Walgreens, Walmart, the big drug stores were filing a lawsuit against the pharmaceutical companies, and they documented the cheapest they could buy these for. These are big bulk buyers. Inderol, which is, I believe, a heart medication, they had to pay $48.32 for 100 pills when some of the hospitals and health plans could buy the same drugs for $4.12. 12-to-1 disparity. It's not volume. Again, these are the big national chains trying to do it. Big lawsuits of how they do it. Oh, rebates. Because the drugstore can't limit access, and so what they do is you buy our drug and we'll give you this rebate, and it's set up so you and your health plan are probably paying on average about what everybody else is. So you're not getting ripped off, you're paying a fair price for it, and but seniors and people without prescription drug companies pay the full price. So I think we need prescription drug price reform desperately. It's about the most profitable business we have, and top 12 drug companies, I mean, the amount they spend on lobbying, on campaign contributions. We see ads in Minnesota, regular, I saw one a few weeks ago, for praising Representative Colin Peterson for voting for prescription drug coverage for seniors. It was paid for by Citizens for Better Medicare, something which is a pharmaceutical lobby paid for thing. It was their bill. He voted for their bill. They're running ads a year and a half before the election praising him for voting for pharma. They call it Seniors for Better Medicare. Who's paid for it? It's entirely paid for by pharma. It's just, they got a lot of lobbying power, a lot of money.
You're going to talk about that tomorrow, right?
I will. I'm happy to go into some tonight. Yes.
This is another subject. Could you comment on the Patriot Act and the prognosis for civil rights and further Patriot Acts and so on?
The Patriot Act, we see the same sort of thing in Minnesota. We're going to, a lot of political pressure. Oh, we take away civil liberties and we'll all be much safer. I don't know who it was. One of our founding fathers, I think, who said that anyone who... Abe Lincoln. I don't remember who, but somebody apparently said, and I've seen this quoted many times.
Benjamin Franklin.
Who?
Benjamin Franklin.
Ben Franklin? The one
he
about
who gives up his liberty,
liberty
for, yeah,
yeah,
freedom.
For freedom, for security, receives neither.
Yeah, or something.
That was the gist of it. And I guess I think that's roughly the case. And the fact that a few people started saying, well, maybe we should only put it in effect and put a sunset on it so it gets repealed in a few years. because we're in this frenzy now, we're going to vote for this stupid thing no matter what's in it. We had a similar issue in Minnesota, very heavy pressure, driver's licenses for immigrants. The way the law was probably wasn't the best, but our driver's licenses in Minnesota expire on your birthday. And so if you had a visa and you were only working here for 2 years and your birthday was a year after that, then you would not lose your driver's license. And somehow, even though our law enforcement officers weren't able to do anything if they found out you had an expired visa, it's not their job, they have no authority over it, nevertheless, they wanted to have it stamped on the driver's license, visa check or something like that, a status check in big letters. And we were saying, well, look, if you need anything on this, let's change it so the date coincides with the expiration of it and don't make a big deal of it. But don't write status check or something right on the license, because frankly, there are lots of business, you cash a check in Minnesota, you show a driver's license. And you rent, you do anything else, a lot of landlords, there's enough discrimination, but oh, the political pressure is fierce on it. And frankly, the department had decided to do this anyhow without legislative backing until the courts told them they couldn't do it. But that was a hot issue in our gubernatorial race last year. I think there's still going to be a trend towards it for a few more years because people are going to think that it somehow makes them safer. But I think long-term people really go back and say, I don't want to lose my liberty because of somebody's attempt to sound like they're being, making us more secure.
John?
Yeah.
Do you think the recent law allowing easier access to handguns and concealed guns in Minnesota was related to this, the same post 9/11 fear stuff, or is it something else?
For other people of other states, which is most of you, I don't know what Washington's laws are on permits to carry guns, but in about 30 some states, if you want to carry a handgun, you have to take a test and you meet certain requirements and you can carry a gun, virtually anyway. Minnesota had a law that said you could get a permit to carry a gun if you had personal fear or job-related need for a gun. Basically meant that some rural communities, the sheriff would give anybody who wanted a gun, but in the Twin Cities area, a permit, in the Twin Cities area, bigger communities, they were saying, what do you need a gun for? Carry a gun around at the grocery store and everything else. And they basically, other than law enforcement and a handful of others, they turned them down. Well, the gun lobby folks, one of my constituents was the one who wrote the thing, and they basically decided that instead of that, they may issue a permit to you if you don't have one of like 10 or 20 disqualifying offenses or things, then instead of they may issue it to you, they shall issue it to you. Which means our law is a lot looser than Texas and a lot of other states that we got one of the loosest in the country now, because in Texas and so on, if you've had any kind of mental illness, you go down a whole list of things, if you're okay, if not, you can't get the permit. In Minnesota, if you've ever been committed for mental illness, a lot of people with psychotic illnesses, lots of mental illnesses may not make you a safety hazard to anybody, but you've got a psychotic type of illness, schizophrenia or something, and you've been in treatment, that doesn't disqualify you. Only if you've been committed against your will, which is a very small percentage of people. Otherwise, the sheriff has to give you a permit. If you've shown yourself to be, or if you've abused your spouse enough that they got an order for protection, banning and restraining order, keeping you away from your own house, which you have to go to court to get because your spouse or family's been able to show you're dangerous. That's not disqualifying unless you've had this order and you violate it. So two strikes against you, then you can't get a permit. But I think it was not so much 9/11, and I think overwhelmingly the public does not support the law. I think there's a strong pressure in Minnesota to repeal it. I think it's better than 2-1 opposition to it, but the NRA type organization has a lot of people who vote on those issues, and legislators are scared silly they're going to be defeated on those issues. And I think there's a chance that one will be repealed or weakened. I don't think the votes are there to repeal it. And it may change. That's the kind of issue that really could change the course of the next election next year, just because I think a lot of people are really, really angry about it. When churches are, we have law, churches filing lawsuits because the law says if you want to stop people from bringing guns to your premises, you have to put a sign saying so-and-so, the name of the organization, the church or whatever, does not allow guns on these premises. And you have to notify people that you got the sign up in case they didn't see it and that you're serious about enforcing it, which got to the joking situation that if you go to a game at the Metrodome for a Vikings game where people, I don't think, want people who have guns in it, are they going to notify every one of 60,000 people going into the turnstile? No guns allowed, no guns allowed. We got it posted, no guns allowed. And in effect, what businesses are doing is they're putting up the little sign, they're ignoring the warning. But we had to do this double step because we didn't want somebody accidentally violating the law. Well, if you do violate the law and they warned you ahead of time they're serious about it, you violate it, then you can get a $25 fine. I mean, that's it. It was not a, it was terrible legislation. They, right after that came out and the church and everybody started suing on that, the governor and others, oh, we didn't know it said you had both post the notice and you had to orally notify people about the notice. No, we didn't know that was, clearly not intended. It was meant the other way. And they were just wanted to change from this and this to this or this. Well, and that clearly wasn't the intent, and I know the author, the guy who wrote the language, and he didn't intend it that way, partly because it says, you must post a sign and you must notify people that you posted the sign. So it clearly couldn't have been, it wouldn't make sense with the or. But they wanted everything, and what about saying that, well, you churches or stores or could post it and so on. The biggest surprise to me was that the business community didn't raise any voice whatsoever on the issue. I think anything happens, any business now that posted, they're going to get sued. If they didn't post, they're going to get sued. And it seems to me that stores, they're all agonizing. Do we post or not? We don't want to offend our customers. I frankly think that a lot of the business community, if it gets overturned, it'll be because they don't like it. But it is
the churches that have really complained about it, pushed it. But I've never talked to a single person who had a clue why the legislature passed that law.
I was pushing for it for 10 years. And I tried a bill several years ago, still hasn't gotten a hearing yet, but it's a bill. I just think, I mean, guns are very prevalent in Minnesota, like I'm sure in Pacific Northwest states and so on. I figured, you know, we could treat them like cars in certain ways. Cars have many legitimate purposes, but they can also be deadly things. And in Minnesota, if you have to have training to have one, you have to have a license for it, you have to register the vehicle. If you do something wrong, you can lose those privileges. You can be drunk driving twice or three times. We can take away your vehicle from you. I thought, why can't we do the same thing with guns? Can't possibly do that. But it's NRA has a lot of power. And it's, again, not percentage of the population. It's just they'll vote on nothing else other than that. And everybody else votes, well, that's an issue of concern. They don't like this law, but they have 50 other concerns. I'll try to be briefer, by the way. Go ahead.
In Oregon, I've seen a lot of people running for state legislature who are art curators or factory owners or data programmers. In general, do you feel your colleagues have any sort of political training, or are they just random individuals who have an opinion on something?
Very much have an opinion on things, and actually a lot of them, though, when I was first elected, I was 30 years old, and I had lots of young college students coming to me saying, hey, they're a political science major, they're going to law school, and they want to know how to run for office. And they're envisioning, hey, 10 years later, maybe they'll be in the legislature. And I always ask them, well, why do you want to be there? What's the purpose? I think they wanted a title in front of their name and thought they'd be important or something. But most legislators, one, they're often involved in other campaigns. They're politically sophisticated that way. I actually think it's a good idea that we have a variety of occupations, so we tend to have certain ones more than others. Farmers, attorneys, we have certain ones more than others. But I would argue that in general, legislators, despite the reputation, they've got lots of failings, and I can go on a length of some things I don't like about it, but I'd say in general, elected officials tend to be harder working than the public believes. There are plenty of exceptions to that, but on average, they're much harder working than people would expect. And boy, there's some really stupid people in politics, but there are a lot of bright people too. Regardless of their opinions on things, there are a lot of smart people. And I would argue most of them very well intentioned, though, and we'll talk about tomorrow with the campaign financing. I think our campaign finance system is the most corrupting influence on our democracy of anything out there. And when I first started raising issues 10 years ago, I authored a bill that after about 4 or 5 years of trying, got a bill through banning gifts from lobbyists and interest groups to legislators and to other public officials. Oh, this is terrible law. How could you? And the first response people always had was, are you saying I can be bought for a dinner? I'm going to sell my vote for a dinner or a ticket to a football game or something else? And you're accusing me of being a crook. And I'm accusing you of being a human being and a corrupt system. People who buy you, give you gifts. Most of politics, this is bizarre. I mean, how many of you ever have strangers, just total strangers, come and give you tickets to a football game or take you out to dinner? It doesn't happen to most people.
The firefighters came and brought us tons of alcohol every Christmas.
First time election, St. Paul firefighters, dropped off several bottles of hard liquor. And I don't drink hard liquor. I don't know what to do with this stuff. But that happened all the time, and it was routine. You get all these tickets to things, and my first year there, the Twins were in the World Series, and some lobbyist who was about my age, and he was a real chummy kind of guy, and he offered me a ticket to one of the World Series games, which were expensive because they were very hard to get. One ticket to one game, I was a freshman member, I didn't merit two tickets to all the games, one ticket to one game, and I'm sure he had the other ticket and would have been sitting right next to me, and I'm sure he would have bought me several beers. We had been talking, and so you couldn't say much about any issues. And one thing the Metrodome in Minnesota has going for it is it's a very loud building, and they warned people that year, bring earplugs, because it was dangerously loud, decibels of 115 or something.
Ooh.
And they warn you of ear damage, and they still do whenever there's a big thing like that. And we weren't going to talk politics, he was just going to do that. And then next year when the legislature's in session, if one of his clients said something, John, you got a minute to talk. They build goodwill, and they gain access to you. Paul Simon, the former U.S. Senator, said once, if you have 20 calls to make when you get back to a hotel room at night and you don't have time to make more than three of them and you recognize two of the 20 people are big donors, you'd be stupid not to call them back. It's human nature, and so I'd argue most politicians in Minnesota, and I would guess in most states, be very few of them who, if you slipped them an envelope with $1,000 of cash and said, here's something for you. By the way, we could use some help on this. I think most of them, if you tried to slip them cash under the table, most of them would run. Whether for fear of getting caught, which may be the thing, but just because I'm not a crook, I wouldn't dare do that. And they'd be offended if you accused them of selling their vote, and I frankly think in most cases, they wouldn't think of selling their vote. But we're human beings, and you do something nice for somebody, they tend to do something nice in return, subconsciously.
Just a little more onto my original question.
Yeah.
I agree that it's great to have a bunch of diversity in types of politicians, but do you see any political science majors?
Oh, I'm sure there are a decent number of them, because again, as I was mentioning, all the young folks who are trying to run for office, political science is a very common major. people always assume, oh, you must have had a political science major. No, I didn't, but I took some political science courses. I paid attention to politics my whole life, but and I don't know that that's what's lacking. I mean, same thing, I'm not a lawyer. I've chaired the Senate Judiciary Committee. That would have been unheard of 30 years ago, but now chairing the Senate Judiciary Committee, being a non-lawyer, I wasn't the first one. I was like the second or third. And yeah, it would help me if I had a law degree in some ways. I think I could bring a lot of experiences that lawyers don't, well, not lawyers as a category don't have, but I think there are lots of other things you can bring to the system than that. It helps to have an understanding of legal concepts. It helps to have an understanding of economics. It helps to have an, I mean, if you want to talk about jack of all trades and master of none, that's what a legislative body deals with. I mean, we're dealing with sewage stuff, kind of like Holden Village folks. I mean, you have to learn about sewage stuff. Well, we spent a lot of time on sewers this year and on septic tank systems and straight line. I didn't know what a straight line septic system was. Well, that's just one where the pipe goes right out from your toilet into the creek, which has been illegal in Minnesota for 50 years, but there's still some of them out there. Well, you learn about these things, and you learn about education policy and healthcare and 50,000 other things. So I'd say the most important qualification that I'd like to have public officials have is one, ability to read and listen well, and two,
think.
A conscience about what's going on.
Philosophy.
Yeah. Philosophy major, we could use more of that. But, yeah, you had a point there.
Well, I was on the lobbies. How does an average citizen get your attention on an issue?
Okay.
Versus the lobbyists, because if you've got 20 calls to make,
right,
you're going to call your three top donors.
Yeah.
How do you?
That's one of the arguments I make for why we need campaign finance reform. And some people, some of my colleagues will say, well, you know, it's the problem that they will insist there's no corruption. It's not a corrupt system. It's only the appearance of corruption. And I thought, well, I'm sorry, I disagree. Bill Moyers wrote a column for Sojourners magazine a few years ago, cover story. The impact of special interest money in politics is not as bad as you think, period. It's worse. Bill Moyers has worked for U.S. president on down, and he's been involved in the political process most of the years as an observer, but an informed observer. He says it's worse than you think, though. So it is, that's the number one thing we have to change on it. But in terms of getting access, and I'm actually supposed to give a talk on this on Thursday, Jubilee Day, because one of the points of Jubilee Day is trying to get people involved in issues affecting their world and community. And well, there are several ways. One is having a compelling story. You got to have access to get it to somebody, but a very compelling story, or sheer pressure, quantity of people doing it, and sheer persistence. I get lots of, well, now emails have replaced the old postcards. I've got lots of postcards. Dear Senator, fill in the blank. I feel very strongly about this and this and this, sincerely. Well, for some people, that made a real difference. If you got a big basket full of postcards coming in, that would have an impact on you. They're the easiest things to respond to, of course, because dear fill in the blank, and with computers, who knows it's dear fill in the blank. Oh, I agree with you on this or this, right? Well, thanks for letting me know your concerns about this. It's the personal story. This year, because of some budget things, I had a constituent who was asking how they could have an impact on major cuts in services to kids with disabilities. How can we have an impact here? And I said, she had brought in a friend who also had a disabled child, and her child was getting services, and she said it saved her marriage, it saved everything. Their family's falling apart because they couldn't handle it all. And she said she brought in this friend who's got a similar severely disabled child who has many needs, and this woman was trying to make it, and she said, I can't, I need to help. And there's a waiting list, and we're cutting back further now. And I said, what you have to do is bring in one of my representatives who I don't think was very sympathetic to the issue. I said, what you have to do is take a day off and bring in Johnny or whatever the kid's name was. bring her 3-year-old kid in and say, you know, I think this guy's pretty important. And I think the state should consider this guy pretty important too. And it was a compelling story to hear her talk about her son and his needs and what it was doing to the family. And I said, you know, compelling stories do a lot of good. You just have to have access to it. But the people who show up and say, look, I'd like to talk to you, they have more impact, more chance of having a say than the people who fill out one postcard or one quick email. But sheer quantity gets a lot of people's attention because politicians live a lot on fear. And I'll talk more. I'll do the whole talk on trying to help people sort through how to do it.
Just to follow up, I think the frustrating thing with access is at the end of the sessions, it's, you know, you talked about how people are working their 40 hours a week. You know, we don't have access when things are happening. And
frankly, the people who are most often hurt by things, the kids, especially kids who are in trouble, kids with chemical dependency or mental health problems and so on, they have no voice. Lobbyists are always at the Capitol, and they should have their right to make their case. They shouldn't be able to gain extra access, in my mind. But yeah, it's not a fair playing field. It's not a level playing field. You have to work extra hard to do it, and you have to hope. And to me, the biggest single change we could make with it, again, is making sure the elected officials are sensitive to it. I shouldn't only be concerned about that need because somebody came in and told me a serious story about it, or because I got 2,000 postcards on it. I should be concerned about it because it's something we should be concerned about as a society. And so I think we have to make sure that people are elected who are beholden to looking out for the public good and not the good of those who gain access. So I, you're right, it's not fair, but that's what we got to try and work at changing. And it's not just the constituent contacting the person, it's the person at the other end who's got to be aware of it anyhow. We have another 10.
I was just wondering, one of the things that, I'm not even sure if I can get this question out right, but there's a lot of mudslinging when it comes to, you know, oh, you want to cut the budget, and that means, drastic changes for people. But, you know, as a, you know, in a family setting, you can change your budget and find a lot of money that is wasted. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about the many millions of dollars in the budget, and you hear about, I can't remember the dollar amount, but somebody up in northern Minnesota is getting $100,000 or $300,000 to taste different hops and different beers. How much, I mean, yeah, it's not a bad job, but I'm not sure that I want to payroll it. Well, I mean, I don't know that cutting the budget equates to cutting where it counts, because I really think that there's a lot of fat in there. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, I have comments on it. One, in terms of, first of all, never, you can't raise taxes, you've got to cut spending. And that we should do like a family does, because I mean, what we kept hearing was, well, the family, if they don't have the money, they cut expenses. But when that means that grandma doesn't get her medication, or Johnny doesn't eat any dinner because we don't have food, or we don't have money for drugs, no, the first thing you do is you don't push the kid off the cliff, you get another job, you bring in more money. So government, in a sense, which does have, I think, is those as serious obligations, yes. Once in a while, I hear all these stories of massive waste, and for there are lots of things in government I don't think we should be spending a penny on. I've spent 6-7 years trying to fight against the most visible things are corporate subsidies for professional sports. I'm a Twins fan, I'm a Vikings fan, I like to go to games, I can't afford the Vikings games, but go to Twins games, and I like them, I think they're assets of the state, but I don't see why in the world we should be subsidizing a private industry that's a for-profit private industry. And frankly, when I can tell you all the subsidies that we give through tax increment financing, which is a clever financing scheme local governments use for development, I can list 100 things that I'd like to see us not put money into, but that doesn't matter because I don't have the votes to stop it. And saying that, okay, well, take the money from that instead of taking away from poor kids. Well, I have one vote, and other legislators each have one vote, and the governor has one vote, and one powerful vote in terms of vetoing things and proposing things. But in terms of, there's a group in Minnesota, you see the Grandma's Marathon shirt and your comment about northern Minnesota. There are a few grants for some renewable energy things related to turkey manure and so on, and boy, those sound kind of bizarre. I have not served, it tends to be the most conservative legislators on this, on our the group that probably funded it, which was the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, which has money that comes from the lottery, and it's been around for a long time for environmental projects. And I've never heard of one on beer and hops tasting, but I have seen some on turkey manure, which is an easy one to ridicule. We also spend some money, farm groups have pushed very hard for some things to get new products out of agriculture things. Some of which, I mean, it tends to be $50,000 grant for something, and whether that's the best use of money, I don't know. But when you're talking of a $14 billion a year state budget, a lot of $50,000 don't add up to a whole lot. And Jonathan Kozel, the author, wrote a book about education, and so he said, you know, the concept that somehow we're going to improve our schools and we're not going to spend any money on it, and that more money won't help with education implies that teachers shouldn't be paid, or textbook manufacturers shouldn't expect money, or utilities shouldn't expect money for heating buildings. Those things, and payroll is obviously the biggest one. I guess I'd love to see us do things. I've proposed many times cutting certain things, but I can't get the votes on that. And some of the people who are most willing to cut health care and so on.
And education.
Those are the ones who say, hey, we gotta spend the money for the stadiums. And the biggest concern I have about the budget cuts, we're not gonna cut our prisons significantly. I mean, we'll cut back on things now, which means basically if you're in prison, you don't get any kind of educational help or chemical dependency help. But since we release people eventually, I don't think that's a good savings. But bottom line, we're not gonna be throwing people out of prison for money reasons. What we are going to be doing is the after-school program for kids with chemical dependency and mental health problems, the counseling, the extra help for them. It saved money because it stops them from going to prison. Last year in Minneapolis, a tragic story, 11-year-old girl was doing her homework at the kitchen table, 2 blocks from our church, and gang shooting and bullet went through the dining window, killed her on the spot, 11-year-old girl. They arrested 2 guys, or may have been a third. They got 2 of them. They'll both serve 30 years in prison. That'll cost us counting prosecution and everything else. I'm sure we'll spend $3 million on those 2 guys. We could have spent a lot less than that on 50,000 kids who are at risk of going into gangs and other things, and we would save money, but the things we're going to cut are the things that a gang strike prevention task force, which is the law enforcement side of that's being cut. We're cutting all the prevention things. Minnesota used to be the land of 10,000 treatment programs. Hazel did some of the best chemical dependency programs in the country there. We're now third lowest in terms of chemical dependency treatment in the country. Georgia and I think Alabama are below us, not Mississippi. Others have more treatment per capita than we do. And that's because of changes in the laws in recent years. But my argument is the biggest way government can save money is by preventing problems. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of care, whether it's health care or education or crime. It absolutely does. Pete Wilson, governor of California, 10 years ago did a study on chemical dependency. Every dollar a taxpayer spent on chemical dependency saved. This is a conservative Republican administration, saved $7 to taxpayers. It's not a 7% or a 17 or a 70% rate of return. It's a 700% rate of return. We know that, but we can't afford it. And I'd say if we want to save money, we're not going to cut cut back, and yeah, the governor says you can cut, oh, any government that can't cut back 5% isn't worth its whatever. Well, you cut 5% this year, you cut this much last year, you cut a little more next year. Eventually, you cut corners to the points where you're penny-wise and pound foolish. That's my view on it. So I disagree with the Taxpayers League, which says we're dumping all kinds of money into all kinds of things, and I'll agree with them on some of the things they don't want to spend money on. I agree with them on that, but bottom line, that's smaller dollar amounts than we need to balance the budget. And we did balance it without state tax increases, though some of the fees are more tax increases. With nursing homes, if you're trying to pay a patient, which most are not, because you go bankrupt pretty quickly when you're paying your own way in a nursing home, and so medical assistance pays your way then. But we put a surcharge of, I think it's like $5-6 a day, maybe it was $15 a day, I heard from several people on it. We put a surcharge on the private pay patients, and it's not going to the nursing home, it's going to help balance the state budget. That's a tax on people who happen to be in nursing homes. It's highly regressive, and it's used to balance the budget, but that's not called a tax, it's called a fee. So those were fees were allowed, and I think it made our tax system more ridiculous, but I didn't even know that much. Anyhow, I think we're 9:30 now. I'm happy to stay around some more, but for the taping purposes, I'll call it quits here. And I hope this is at least a perspective that you don't always have a chance to hear from, and I'll be around.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.